If you want to be a great long-form improviser, there is no substitute for doing good, solid two-person scenes. Edits aren't going to save you. Walk-ons aren't going to save you. A new form is not going to save you. It's going to always come down to the same thing. Are you able to do good two-person scenes? So if you're a seasoned improviser and you feel a little rusty, or you're like, oh, I can't get out of my improv comfort zone, which means I'm doing the same types of scenes over and over again, and I'm not challenging myself, I'm frustrated, I want to quit. I know I don't want you to go to a dark place, even though I'm a dark guy. I want to prevent you from that, because sometimes all it takes is a little tweaking and you're back on the path. So I'm offering my advanced level two-person scene tune-up one-day workshop online. I'm offering it online. This is an advanced level on May 23rd, Saturday, May 23rd, from 1 to 3:30 p.m. Central Standard Time. Now, I'm only limiting this to 10 people. That's it, 10 people. And right now, if you sign up, it's $69. And you can do that by going to my website, jimmycorain.com. That's jimmycorain.com. I want to help you get emotionally connected to your partner, making strong choices out there. And I want you to do some of your best and inspired scene work yet. Just go to my website, sign up today at jimmycorain.com. That's jimmycorain.com.
Jimmy, Jimmy Corain, Jimmy Corain's a nerd. Jimmy Corain's an improv nerd. Jimmy Corain's a nerd.
Hello, everybody. This is Jimmy Corain, the host of Improv Nerd. Our guest today is Rich Baker. He is the author of the new book, Improv Made Easier. Rich has been improvising for 20 years. He is an incredible improv teacher. He currently teaches at the Second City in Hollywood, as well as he teaches and coaches online. Rich has performed with the Second City, Comedy Sports, IO Chicago, and he's toured with Mission Improvable. We talked to him about how he first got started in improv, how he ended up moving to Chicago, and then eventually moving to Los Angeles. We then shift the conversation to talk about specific things in his book that will help you with your scene work, why it's so important to start in the middle of a scene, asking questions, how to deal with anger and arguments in a scene, object work, working one line at a time, and his concept of going from discovering the scene from the inside out or going from vague to clear. I usually have a little anecdote or something from my life in this part of the show, but I don't really have anything. So instead, I would just like to get to this episode because it's so good. Here it is, the Rich Baker episode. Enjoy.
Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd, oh yeah. Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd.
Rich Baker, thank you so much for being my guest on Improv Nerd.
Oh, thanks for having me. I've been a fan of yours for quite some time, so it's an honor to be on your show.
Thank you. I appreciate it. It makes me a little uncomfortable. people say that they're fans of mine.
Are you telling me an improviser is uncomfortable with praise? How dare you, sir? It's never happened before.
How do you take compliments when people say, hey, great show?
Way better than I used to. I was very much the typical, like I was literally on a podcast yesterday where the host, like I was saying like, oh, I just really love your show, this and the other. And he was like, oh, I didn't bring people on to do that. You know, and I was like, oh, that's extremely reminiscent of how I used to be. And now I take it much more with stride. And I'm like, thank you very much. I appreciate it. And then it's just full stop.
How did you get to that place?
A lot of inner work. One thing, there's this movie that not a lot of people have seen. It's a little independent movie called Half Magic. And in the movie, the main protagonist, she also is bad at taking compliments. And someone, I can't remember exactly how it goes in the movie, but someone teaches her how to take a compliment by saying, thank you, it's true. And so someone would be like, you look really beautiful today. And she goes, thank you. It's true. And like, you know, and there was something about that. And I don't say those words usually, but there's something about that sentiment that I'm like, I do sound good, or I did have a good show or whatever. And I'm like, thank you. That is a true thing. And I appreciate that you noticed.
So take me back. You're 17, 18 years old. You live in Texas, right outside of Dallas, Fort Worth, Texas. And you're into theater, you do plays, you sing. And then all of a sudden, before you turn 17 or 18 years old, you get exposed to improv.
Yeah, so I'm pretty sure Whose Line Is It Anyway had been on the air. I know it had been on the air in Britain for a while. I think it had been on the air in America, but it had not crossed my radar at that point. So improv was this completely new concept to me. I was a few months away from turning 18. I was actually at my friend's 18th birthday party. It was an outing. And we went to see this thing called 4-Day Weekend in downtown Fort Worth. And I didn't know anything about it. No one in the party actually knew anything about it. And the birthday girl just knew it was a show of some kind and had been highly recommended. So we, you know, 17, 18-year-old kids, we go downtown thinking we're all fancy. And we go into this very fancy building. Second floor, big, you know, real nice posh bar and everything. And then we walk into the actual theater, 212 seats, graduated seating, huge floor space. They've got multimedia. I mean, this is back in 1999. And I was just blown away. And then they claimed they were going to improvise. And I was just like, what? That's not a thing. And so they start doing this show. And I remember, I'll never forget the first thing they did, you know, the host comes out and does the host thing for a second. But then the first game they played was forward reverse. And my 17-year-old mind was just devastated because everything I thought I knew, I didn't know. Because, I mean, assuming they're accurate, assuming that they're truthful and they're actually making up, which I did not believe. I really walked out of that show going, no, they didn't. They're pulling the wool over our eyes. They're trying to lie to us.
For people that don't know forward or reverse, can you explain it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's an improvised scene where, you know, the scene starts out like normal. So someone would be like, welcome to my factory. And be like, oh, here you go. And then the host will say reverse. And then the dialogue and the action is going to go in reverse from that order. So it's like, hey, everyone, what's going on? Reverse. Hey, everyone, what's going on? And you like reverse back through it, which is now it's been my favorite game forever, but it was the first thing I saw. So not only are they improvising a scene, but they're remembering what they did and they're going back and forth. And no matter when he says forward or reverse, the scene's like clockwork, just moving one way or the other. And I was just like, what is happening? So at the end of it all, at the end of the show, I literally thought, oh, they're trying to pull the wool over our eyes. So I went back every week. Back then, they had a show one night a week on Fridays and Saturdays, one time a night. And so I went back to the Friday show and the Saturday show for like 6 weeks in a row, trying to catch them repeating a joke or something. I was, you know, like repeating the same stuff, and they never did. So finally, I approached them afterwards, and I was like, are you really improvising? And the guy was like, yeah. I go, how is that even possible? And he goes, we got classes.
So then you start taking classes there. And how does somebody who had worked with scripted work all of a sudden is blown away by this? What's more freeing for you in doing this kind of work versus doing plays?
You know, I'd say they're both freeing in several ways. One thing I love about doing scripted work is that you've got the freedom to not have to come up with the words because there's a lot of pressure on that. But what I really loved about it was that, you know, I'm a 17-year-old kid. There's not a lot of good theater that I've been exposed to, you know, monologues or 17-year-olds or scenes or plays. You know, there weren't a lot of roles. And in high school, as most high schools typically, you know, you're playing people much older. You know, you're in Death of a Salesman at 17. You're not going to get cast as Death of a Salesman until, you know, like 40 years later. But in improv, you can play anyone. You can play an old man. You can play a turtle. You can play, you know, George Washington. Like it does, you can play anything you want. And that just, I was like, I can make my own characters and my own voice and not have to be stuck to a page. And that was just really freeing to me right from that spot. And I just, my 17-year-old energy was like, let's do everything.
Because I would imagine 1999, you might've been one of the youngest people in the class.
Definitely.
And what was that experience like?
Pretty good. I mean, I would say I was the youngest, but only by a couple of years. And then they had four levels at the time. And I think by the time I got into level three, some other people had joined from different levels. And then I was no longer the youngest. I was older than a couple of people. But, you know, at that point, I really didn't know any better. You know, I'd always kind of gotten along with adults, even as a real tiny kid. I think I was kind of old for my age when I was like four. So like being in a class with someone in their 30s or 40s, really, it not only didn't bother me, it felt more comfortable. If I had been in a class full of 18, 19 year olds only, I probably would have been just as intimidated in that class as I felt like in school or any place else in life.
And then you go off to college, TCU, and you start your own improv group. And then when you're done, you decide you're going to go to Chicago.
Yeah.
How'd you come up with that decision?
So I just want to be super fair. I was one of the people who started the improv troupe, but it was not like my idea where I was like, everyone, I'm going to lead this. There was another guy who was experienced in 4-day weekend, but we weren't in the same class at the time. And he basically put a thing out that was like, interested in improv? I'm going to put together an improv troupe. And so everyone who showed up on that first day, we all call ourselves co-founders, but the guy who put it together, I really think that he's the guy who found it. Andrew Hamer, if you know he is, he actually does 4-day weekend now. He's been a part of their troupe for a few years, but we moved to Chicago together. And anyway, so how that happened was, so we started this improv troupe. We didn't know what we were doing. You know, we're just a bunch of kids with no
long
leader.
Long form or short form?
Both. We mixed it up. We didn't even know format. You know, we would just like do a game and then we'd do like a series of scenes and then, you know, back to a game and just all over the place. Stuff we'd find on, you know, back then it wasn't even Google. Back, you know, we'd find stuff on like Yahoo or Metacrawler or one of those other search engines. Just, oh, this is a description of a game. Let's play it. So we did that for, I did for two and a half years, year and a half, something like that. And then when I graduated, I'd fallen in love with improv hardcore. I was a film major and I loved doing film, but I really like loved this idea of being on stage, being an actor, being, you know, the talent. So I said, I'm going to put my film degree on hold and I'm just going to pursue this hardcore. The other people who were in the troupe in college that we found it together, they were younger than me by a semester or two, and some of them wanted to move to Chicago. And I'd always wanted to leave Fort Worth, but I didn't really have a plan. Like, I liked New York, and I'd heard of L.A., but I'd never been, and I'd never been to Chicago. So I wanted to go somewhere, and they were very determined on going to Chicago. And I thought, well, if I'm going to go somewhere I don't know anyone, I might as well go with people that I know. And so I waited, I think, two more semesters for them to finally graduate, and that's when we made the big leap. And none of us knew anyone in Chicago. We didn't have any family. We literally were just four guys who got up there and were like, now what?
What's the advantage to wait and go with a group of people?
I don't think I personally would have had the resolve to stick it out on my own. I don't know that for sure, but I have a feeling if it wasn't for those three other guys, that I don't think I would have gotten as plugged in with other people as quickly. I don't think I would have had that support system. Like if I try to find an apartment on my own or move into, you know, some strangers, be someone's roommate, I think I probably would have just hightailed it back to Fort Worth with my tail between my legs sometime. Cause I mean, I thought about it several times in my first couple of years in Chicago, but having those guys there and then eventually the other friends and support system that I would meet in Chicago was extremely helpful. But yeah, I needed them to get there.
And then when you're there, you study at Second City and the Conservatory and then I.O., Chicago. And you said you had a teacher, Michael Patrick O'Brien, or back then it was Patrick O'Brien,
yeah,
who was a real influence on you. Can you tell us a little about that?
I had a lot of great teachers, but he was a teacher in a way that was specifically different than anything I had experienced before or really since. He walked in on the first day, and I remember it was, so at the time there were six levels at IO. You know, there was 1 through 5 and then 5B, because why call it 6? I think they changed that, but he was my level 4 teacher. And he walked in right on time. I think it was an afternoon class, so like noon to 3 or something like that. He walks in right on time. There's no preamble. There's no, hey, what's up? My name is blah, blah, blah. He didn't care about any of that. He walked in and he goes, form a back line. What's going to happen is two of you are going to come out and improvise a scene. It's going to go on for a few seconds. I'm going to say scene. Everyone's going to do one simultaneous clap. And then two other people would come out and do a different scene. Questions? And we were all just like, what? Okay. So we, you know, we just run, get in this back line and two people come out and do a scene and he goes, scene. And then, you know, there's probably like 12, 15 people in the class and some of us clapped, some of us didn't. We didn't clap all at the same time. And he just kind of looks at us and goes, so perhaps you didn't hear me. I said, when I say scene, one simultaneous clap from everyone. And like, he wasn't mean about it. He wasn't, but he was very much like, we're doing this my way. This is my class. I'm leading this class. I will make you better, but you will, this is not fuck around. Can we curse on here?
Yeah.
This is not fuck around time. This is, you know, this is very much like, you will do what I say and you will get better. And that's that. And that whole term. And again, he was never mean. And like outside of class, like I knew him a little bit, so we were kind of friendly, but in class, it was all business, which allowed for more fun and a lot more growth than I had experienced. And that really spoke to me. And I just remember thinking, you know, if I'm ever a teacher, which was one of my goals at the time, that I want part of this Pat O'Brien persona. I want to explore what that's like in me.
So you had two goals when you were in Chicago, and one you just spoke about was becoming a teacher. Mm-hmm. And the other was being hired and being on main stage, a Second City. I had the same goal. I didn't achieve that goal, which I would imagine, you know, for me was a huge disappointment. I would imagine you might have some feelings around that too.
Big
How
time.
Did you get over that disappointment?
Took a long time, brother. It was one of those things where I had firmly affixed this one solid goal in my head so badly that anything less than that made me feel like I wasn't worthy. Like I had this weird mentality, I wouldn't say weird. I had a mentality back then that was very harmful, but I don't think it was weird at all. I think it was very common and probably still is, which is if I'm not the best in my high school, then how am I ever going to be anything when I'm in college? If I'm not the best when I'm in college, how am I going to be anything when I'm at this theater? If I'm not the best here, like, how am I ever going to get past this line if I'm not crushing it where I'm at? And so to me, like, main stage was, you know, if you get on Second City's main stage, like Steve Carell or Tina Fey or any people like that, then you get to be in the movies and the TV. And of course, that's not even true. There's plenty of people have been on main stage who haven't necessarily, you know, either by choice or circumstance, made that leap in the career. But I mean, it tore me up for a long time. Like it took me years to get over it. I'd say the first two or three years I was in LA, I still thought like, what did I do wrong? Why didn't I get it? What's wrong with me? And eventually, you know, and it's funny because I remember Tim Mason, who was on main stage for a while and who's now a director and creator of the Showtime show Work in Progress, which is awesome. But he gave me some really good advice. I want to say this was back in like 2010 when he was on the main stage. And he said, the main stage is a great job. And it's awesome to want to be there. But if that's your only goal with so few spots and so many people wanting it, like it's a recipe for disappointment. And what I wish I could go back and tell myself, which I can't, but I'd like to tell others, is if you have one particular goal, maybe it's worth dissecting that. What is it that you want out of that goal? And are there other ways to achieve it? Or is the thing that you want out of it actually not anything that you want anymore, but something, a vestigial, you know, thing that you wanted back in the time, and now you're just on automatic pilot thinking you need this thing, but you don't need this thing because it's satisfying something you no longer want.
And the second goal, and we talked about it just a couple of seconds ago, is becoming a teacher. Mm-hmm. And in Chicago, that's where you learned to be, you know, you got to coach improv teams and teach and stuff like that. And what was it in the classroom the first couple of times that you just fell in love with it?
I've kind of always had a teacher's mentality. I learn best. I'm happy to read a book, listen to a lecture, sit in a class. I love learning, but the thing that makes me learn things more than anything else is teaching. And I think a lot of us teachers, I'm sure you can relate to that, of like, once you teach it, it gets in your bones, you know? And, I remember in college, I took this math course. It was like a 2-week, not got a whole semester of algebra in 2 weeks. And pretty much everyone in the class who was taking it hated math. That's why they were trying to get over with real quick. So we would be in class like 5 hours a day. And afterwards, there was no one else using the classroom. So I would just stick around and do homework. And after the first day, people came up to me and they're like, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm just doing the homework. And they said, so you understand this? I was like, yeah. And they're like, teach me. And so like the teacher would go for like 5 hours a day. And then I would stay after unofficially and be like the tutor for, you know, half the class who stayed. And I'd be on the whiteboard, like doing stuff and it helped me understand algebra way better. And it helped a lot of people get it. And that's just who I am. Like I've if I know something and you want to learn it, I'm begging, please let me teach you, because I've loved that. So for me, improv was always one of those things of like, this is kind of weird. How do I get my head around it? And once I did, I'm like, I have to teach everyone who's willing to listen.
And that leads to the book, Improv Made Easier. There it is right there. If you're listening to the podcast, Rich just held up a copy of his book in beautiful orange and blue colors cover.
Thank you. Shout out to Oliver Berger, who designed the cover on this.
He did a great job. And there's actually a Bentwood chair missing a leg. And then there's two numbers to that you're going to teach us in the book how to reassemble the leg of the chair.
Jimmy Crane, thank you so much, because you're one of the first people who's actually understood what we were going for. A lot of people are like, why do you have a broken chair? And I'm like, it's not broken. I'm showing you how to put it together. And anyway, thank you.
You say in the first chapter why you wrote this book. Can you explain to the audience and the listeners why you wrote it?
I wrote this book for a few reasons, but the main thrust of it is that I've been teaching for 16 and a half years now. And like I assume everyone does, it's you evolve over time. So, you know, the way that I started teaching in 2006 is very different from what I teach now, as I've learned and gotten experience and whatnot. And, you know, so I'm always like taking things and trying, let me experiment with this lesson or this way of putting it or this way of demonstrating whatever, or this exercise. And over the last few years, as far as my workshops and classes that I teach two-person scenes, I have found that there's a stable of lessons that when I teach people these lessons in two-person scenes, the overall success of the class goes up, the fun goes up, you know, it helps people to really get their head around it. I'm not going to name names, but I've had some teachers in the past, not all, but some, who when they give direction, when they give notes and feedback, when they try and explain things, it was just too esoteric for me. It was nothing for me to really grab onto. There wasn't anything super concrete. And so my goal has always been, if I learn how to explain something or give feedback in a way that's extremely concrete, that you can really wrap your head around, then that's what I'm going for. And I discovered that over the years, I found ways to do that was helping people over and over. And I thought, okay, I've clearly stumbled onto something that works, that helps people. So I want to write this down in a book so that, you know, because I'm not going to get to teach everyone that I want to. And, you know, more people are going to read this book than are going to have me in a class. And I thought, okay, if I found some lessons that are actually worthwhile of helping improvisers, then here it is. And I'm going to put it in the best way that I can.
What have you found to be the most effective way to give notes?
For me, the most effective way to give notes is to have some kind of rubric to put them against, right? So, you know, two students do a scene and it doesn't go well. For me, I've got all these guideposts of good scene work that are in the book that are like, okay, were you strangers? Did you start in the middle? You know, did you go on a lot of monologues or did you do one line at a time? And to me, that's kind of a baseline to go, okay, the scene was missing this and it was missing this and you fell into this pitfall and this pitfall. So my notes are going to be, okay, here's how we can avoid this. Here's another alternative of how you could have done it. One note that I say a lot is, I'm not dictating what your choice is, but I need you to make a choice. So oftentimes, you know, there'll be times in a scene where someone's just really kind of yesing without an and, so to speak. And so I'm like, you gotta have a reaction. You gotta have a choice. You know, every moment should be responded to. I tell people there should be a cheerleader in your head every time you're in an improv scene that says, be affected. Be affected, right? You should be affected by every moment. So I start out with that. If the scene doesn't comport to those guideposts, or if it did, but it still didn't work, then I go a layer deeper and I go, okay, here's what I think happened. I think there was a disconnect here. I think she meant this, but you took it this way, or, you know, something like that.
I think, you know, you talk about the making an emotional reaction to something. And I found that if you make a strong emotional reaction, the emotion can carry you through the scene.
100%.
So give me an example of an exercise you do to get one of your students or a couple of your students to react emotionally.
Yeah, so I have a whole workshop that I've been teaching for years called Emote Control, and it's all about it's all about exercising your emotions, I'm trying to think of the word, but like basically getting a handle on your emotions. So I equate it with a singer, right? So a singer has a top note and a bottom note, and a good vocalist who's trying to always sound good is going to either keep working their high range and low range to expand them, or to make sure that their top and bottom notes sound really good, and to know what they can't hit, what they can't. And I think with actors, our emotional ranges are the same thing. And a lot of us, most people, go through their lives day to day not experiencing any extreme emotions, or very, very few, right? And yet when we get on a stage, we have this unfair expectation that when the moment calls for it, that we can just zoom up to a 10 on whatever emotion we're feeling. Like, that's not fair. That's like trying to hit an A natural and you never practice. So I run them through a lot of exercises where they're like just like feeling their emotion and emoting at people. And then when they'll do a scene, you know, if they don't have one, I go, stop right there. Okay, we're going to take it back a line. All right, she's going to say that same line to you, but this time whatever emotion you have, you're going to turn it up to like at least a 7. And I don't care what emotion it is, but I need it to be there. And then the next step is, okay, now they've brought the emotion. Is it ground enough to be believable? So that's where the acting comes in.
You also talk about in your book the importance of failing.
Absolutely. Yeah, you got to fail. You got to be, I mean, I grew up hearing about prodigies. Like, I remember there was a movie in the early 90s called Searching for Bobby Fischer, and it was about this like 5-6-year-old kid or something who was just like a chess genius. He could just see everything and move, right? And then we hear about Beethoven, who composed his first symphony at like 6 or something like that, right? And so I really believe that the way the world works was that there were, you know, there's just people out there who get it, and there's people who don't. And that is just not true. There are people out there who are a little more primed to get certain things. And, you know, maybe you might be naturally athletic or naturally good at music, but that doesn't make you great. You still have to work at it. But here's the thing, even if it doesn't come naturally to you, and improv comes naturally to some people and doesn't to others, but regardless, you have to work. And the only way to get better at anything is to fail. That's the scientific method, right? Try an experiment. It doesn't work. So now modify it. Try it again. Try it again. Try it again. And with improv specifically, I think that I don't know how many scenes I had to perform before I felt like I was consistently good, but it was a lot. So I had to fail a lot before I started to, you know, I'd have little successes here and there, but as far as before I felt consistent, I failed over and over and over and over and over. So what I tell my students is just get those failures out of the way. Just pretend there's like a big chalkboard and you're just like, failed a scene. Awesome. Failed a scene. It's like you're building railroad tracks that you're eventually going to get to success.
And the other thing that you stress in the book is our goal as improvisers is to get to consistency.
Yeah.
Which I think is very interesting. And when I read it and I thought to myself, well, I don't think I'm there yet after 30 years, but I think for me, and I'd certainly like to know your opinion on this. Consistency doesn't mean we're not going to have a bad show, you know, ever again. But for me, Right. It's been my level of bad shows they become higher and higher. Like,
yep.
It's not the same as it was when I first started or even a couple of years ago.
Absolutely. And like, as any good improviser, right? Like you 30 years in, you're not like, I got this. Like you're always trying to improve. Right. I always find it weird when people are like, oh, I learned improv. It's like, you didn't learn improv. You learned some of improv, but you never stop learning improv. Like no one's perfect at it. There's two things I want to say on that. One is it's exactly what you said about the paradigm, right? So my worst show in 2006, if it was down here, my worst show is now here. Right. My best show in 2006 was here. My best show in 2020 is, you know, off the screen here. So like you make your lows higher and your highs higher to where your threshold, like I'm not perfect, but I'm never going to do a scene as badly as I would have done 15, 20 years ago. But the other thing is batting average. Right. So, you know, for people who don't follow baseball, I'm not a big baseball fan, but I do know that the best batters in the world, I think Ty Cobb had like the best batting average of all time. And he was like just under 40% or something like that. 40%. That's less than half. And so I don't think, I think improvisers can get their batting average up higher than that, but it's never perfect, right? Anytime you step up to the plate, there's always a chance you can strike out, and that's okay. But it's how often do I strike out? How badly do I feel? And even if you do a bad scene, you know, once you've done a bunch, you realize it's not the end of the world. And that, you know, if you did something wrong, you apologize to your teammate and say, hey, I shouldn't have called you out on that. That was a dick move or whatever. Usually you don't have to because it was just happened. But sometimes you made a bad move. And then you're okay with failure and you just get better as you do it.
So let's talk about some stuff you talk about in the book. And one thing is how do you deal with questions when a student or a performer, asks a lot of questions.
Within a scene?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. So yeah, I get asked questions all the time. I handle those very differently than in a scene.
Rich,
so
do you think I have what it takes to make it?
I think you're going places, kid. Okay. I think you're going places.
You ever get
you're
going to
be on
one?
SNL.
People put you aside. Okay. What do you tell them when they?
I tell them that one, I'm not the authority, and that two, there is no authority. Even if you're talking to Lauren Michaels, like all he can tell you is whether he thinks that you're good enough for his show in that moment, right? Steve Carell wasn't on Saturday Night Live and he did fine. So like there's no authority out there that can say you're good, you've got this. I think we all want that. I know I asked for that as a student of like, am I good enough to make it? It's like, it's not up to your teachers. It's not up to anyone else. Right. Do you have the fortitude and consistency to keep trying no matter what? That's the question.
So getting back to the original question, which was about how when students or improvisers are asking a lot of questions on stage, how you help them get over.
So there's a couple of things. One is, and I know that you know this, but if you ask a question on stage, it's not going to tank the scene necessarily. But what it does is it tends to slow things down. If I ask you a question in a scene, I'm putting you on the spot to come up with information. Now you, Jimmy Crane, of course you're going to be able to come up with something, but it's still, it's like I'm putting that on you. Whereas I think in improv, we have our most success when we put it on ourselves. So I have a little procedure that I tell my students is, and you know, when we're practicing, I'm like, okay, if you ask a question, I'm going to say timeout and we're going to stop the scene and you're going to take 10, 15, however, how many seconds, no rush, but however long it takes to go through the simple procedure, which is step one, ask yourself the question that you just asked your scene partner. So if you just asked your scene partner, hey, what color is your new car? They could provide an answer, but they don't know any more than you do, right? There is no car. They're not really them. You know, you're asking the actor to supply some information that's not there. They'll say, ask yourself the question. Whatever answer you come up with is right. Because
okay, so I'm the student, and I just ask the question, what color is the car?
Yep.
Okay, so now what are you going to tell me?
Now ask your, so you asked me, what color is your car? So now ask yourself, what color is his car? All right, step
okay,
one.
Okay, I got it. Do I tell
step
you?
Step two.
Okay. Okay.
So then step two is just provide an answer. Pick one. Any answer you want. What color is the car?
Gray.
Great. Third thing. Now, this is the thing, the linchpin in this whole process, which is what emotional response do you have to that car? How do you feel about the fact that the car is gray?
I'm jealous.
Perfect, right? And any emotion works. So jealousy is perfect, right? So the car is gray and I'm jealous. Now the last step is we're going to go back in time in that scene before you ask that question. And now you're going to say a statement that conveys two pieces of information, that the car is gray and that you're jealous.
Okay, great.
So like what would a statement be in that situation, for example?
Oh, I love your gray new car.
Perfect. Exactly. You just showed jealousy. You told me the car was great. You didn't ask me a question. You just provided me information to react to rather than giving me an assignment.
And now this gives me a whole point of view. I'm like, did your dad buy it for you?
Sure. Yeah. Right. And then you can turn that into a statement too, right? It's like, oh, I wish my dad bought me a new car. Right.
Right.
And then boom, you're off to the races. Now, again, I'm not telling people that they should eliminate all questions, you know, forever and ever, but it just, it helps my students and me so much more when they make these statements out of their questions rather than ask the questions that I'm like, I think this works. I think we're going to go with it.
Can you tell, because I can sometimes, when students are asking because they're nervous versus acting at, well, it's just a natural part of the scene and natural part of dialogue.
Yeah. I'd say usually I only get the latter when I'm teaching master's levels, which I like teaching people who have a lot of experience. Don't get me wrong. I love the little nuance, but
I do too.
Yeah. But well, clearly, yeah, you're a master's level teacher way more than I am. But you know, what I find a lot more satisfying is when I'm teaching the people who are still just dealing with trying to get all the processes going. Right. But if, you know, two experienced people are doing a scene, you know, if you and DJ Jagodowski are doing a scene and you ask each other a question, I'm pretty sure it's not only not going to derail the scene, it's not even going to give either one of you a moment of pause. Mm-hmm. My two person independent team, Roland and Rich's, you go back and look at our shows that we have on tape and there's tons of times where Roland will ask me a question or I'll ask him a question, but it doesn't stop us because we're flowing through it. It's not putting me out to ask me a question. It's actually giving me a gift because I like coming up with answers, but that's because I've done all the work to get there.
Right. And I've also experienced, if you're working with people you've worked with for a long time, sometimes questions you're setting your partner up.
Absolutely. And if you know them that well, then that's a gift.
You know,
at the end of the day, that's what we're doing, is giving each other gifts.
Yep. And you also talk about object work. And I almost think, you know, we've been around a long time. Object work is become like a lost art. And you say in your book, better space work, which is object work, usually means better scene work. Can you explain?
Yep. One, it's just an observation numbers thing. As far as like, if you watch TJ and Dave, which I know we've both seen plenty of their shows, their object work is so on point, right? And they're amazing. And yet, and other teams, you know, when you watch their object, if they're good, it just tends to line up and correlate. But I think there's a causation too, because if I'm like, what's up? You can't see a phone here. I don't feel a phone here. And the audience certainly doesn't see a phone here. What we see is someone indicating a phone, right? So when I hold a phone like this and I'm like, yeah, tell me more. It feels to me like I'm doing the thing that my character's doing. It looks to the audience and to you like it. So it sinks us more into the reality of the scene, right? The minute that I do this, I'm forcing people to, in their mind's eye, to see a cup in my hand. By making the audience imagine a cup in my hand, they are now more, they're participating in the show unconsciously, without even realizing it, connecting them more to our scene work. And it's connecting you and me more because you see the cup, and then I might even hand you the cup and now you take it. And then we're building this world that's not only in our minds, but it's also tactile in a very real way.
I'm sure you've experienced this. There's no better feeling than when you feel the environment or see the environment. It's very gratifying.
Oh yeah. And I tell my students, I'm like, there's no reason to do a scene void of any object work, right? So one scenario I'll give them is, and I won't tell them this, but I'll be like, okay, your suggestion is waiting in line for a concert. And what happens? Almost inevitably, no one does any object work because they're like, well, I'm just waiting in line. What object work do I do? I'm like, I get that in real life, if you're waiting in line for concert, you might not be touching anything, but we're doing theater. And so if you're just standing there, I'm not picturing you waiting in line for a concert. I'm just seeing you on a stage. But the minute you look at your imaginary watch or mess with your imaginary phone or your necklace or your hat or whatever, now I'm forced to see more than just the stage, more than what you're wearing, more. I'm starting to visualize it. And that is important.
Why do you think improvisers resist it today?
One, I honestly think it's on us teachers. I don't think we do a good enough job. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure there are individual teachers who do, but I'm saying as a whole, object work in my education, at least, and what I see from a lot of other people, is just more like, oh yeah, just make up your object work. Just pretend to do things. And I'm like, people study mime for 20, 30 years before they feel good at it. And we're just telling these improvisers to get on stage and just do it. I'm like, come on. I know that object work is the least fun part of improv for most people. For most people, they want to do the characters, the emotions, the voices, the funny bits, the good wordplay, and the object work's just like something they have to do. But I'm like, we're not doing radio, guys. We're doing theater. So like, show me that thing. And then you can actually find ways to be inspired by the fact that you're holding a cup. Like that can speak to your character, speak to your emotional state, all that kind of stuff.
You also talk about in the book, starting in the middle. Why is it so important to start in the middle of a scene?
Because the beginnings and endings of scenes are typically boring. Again, there is a ratio. Sometimes the beginning of a scene is extremely interesting. Sometimes the end is extremely interesting. But in all the improv scenes I've ever seen, watched, or coached, or done, usually the fun part's in the middle. So there's that. But the other thing is, if we start a scene and the opening line sounds like we're already in the middle of our interaction, what happens is the you'll and a good opening line to a scene that starts in the middle, you'll watch an audience and you'll even see people will kind of lean forward a little bit as if they've got to play catch up. Like, oh God, I'm behind. Right? If you start a scene like, hey, Frank, welcome to my deli, people tend to relax back into it and be like, oh, I get it. They're in a deli. You know, there's some preamble here. But if I'm like, and this sandwich is going to win first prize, people are like, wait, what's happening? Who's got a sandwich? What? And they're just like, pff. it's like they panic for a moment and go and pay attention more.
What's the quickest way to get to the middle of the scene? Just
the way I like to say it is, whatever you're doing, wherever you are, you've already been there at least 5 minutes. You've already been doing that thing for at least 5 minutes. You're not going to leave or stop doing that thing for at least 5 minutes. And since most scenes are less than 5 minutes, we're just going to see the middle.
You also talked about in your book, arguing in scenes, which I didn't. Can you explain? Because that can be a trap. And I think it's different than being angry in a scene. Would you agree?
Absolutely. I tell my students all the time, I'm like, you can be any emotion you want. And there's nothing wrong with being anger. But the minute you put anger at your scene partner, what you are doing is you're making it much more difficult for you and your scene partner to connect. And, you know, walk down Michigan Avenue in Chicago or Hollywood Boulevard or any place. Well, not now because there's no one out, but like in a pre-COVID world, if two people who you don't know at all are arguing, most of us have the same reaction. Get me out of here, right? I don't want to be here. This is uncomfortable. Very few times you see two people arguing and you're like, I want to see what's going on, right? We think that arguing is awesome because in movies and sketches and different written things, it can be, but usually in those instances, it's paying off something that we saw earlier, or it's setting something up that we're going to see later, or we've gotten to know these two characters. So the fact that they're arguing is full of tension, and we're like, who's going to win? What's going to happen? In an improv scene, we don't know the characters. We haven't had time to build a relationship. There's nothing that, I mean, if you're doing narrative improv, that's different, but if we're just doing disparate scenes like most people do, two people arguing is not interesting. And it rarely goes anywhere. Usually it's just it's like the old Monty Python sketch, The Argument Clinic. It's just an automatic naysay. So you're like, it's a beautiful day. And I'm like, it's not a beautiful day. And you're like, it is a beautiful day. No, it isn't. Yeah, it is. No, it isn't. And it's like so boring and draining. And we're like, I'm as an audience member, I'm like, why are they arguing? Why is it important? Why do I care about these two? You know, like it just lowers your chance of success. So I say, if you're gonna be angry at someone, be angry at the boss who's not in. We're a couple factory workers and we can be like, oh, that boss, he would not give me the overtime I wanted, right? And now we're mad at someone who's out here, which brings us closer together.
Mm-hmm. And then you also talk about discovering the scene from the inside out, or vague to clear.
Yeah. This is a specific thing that I've never heard it put that way, at least by anyone else before. If I have, apologies. But I think I came up with this is the idea of, and I don't typically teach this to my beginner students. I usually wait till they're at least intermediate or master's levels to teach this, because a lot of the scenes that I have felt really good about performing and that I have really loved watching other people do, I don't always know what's going on in the beginning. And I know this flies in the face of the whole get out the who, what, and where in the first three lines. It's not my thing. If you're going for gamey scenes and you get out the first three lines, you know, who, what, and where, you're going to be able to play that game probably better. But for my money, that vague to clear, just if you just start out and just go like, can't believe I'm in this again.
Yeah.
That could be anything.
Let's just do anyone. A little piece and see if we can
please.
Find it.
All right, great. Please.
How do you want to start with? Okay.
Yeah. I can't believe I'm in this again.
Yeah, I know.
We're going to escape this time. And this time, it's permanent.
Because I'm not going back to jail.
No, man, we were set up.
I am pissed at your brother, I'll tell you.
We're going to get out of here. And we're going to make him confess on tape. Because that's the only thing that's going to get us out of this.
Yeah. He's got all the money in the trunk now.
Slimy bastard's probably already halfway to Mexico. We're going to have to search for him.
He hasn't returned my messages. I called him 5 minutes ago.
Oh, that bastard. Hey, look at this. I found the opening. I found the escape hatch.
Okay. Cool. Good for you. Okay.
Ready to do this?
Yeah, I'm in.
Let's go.
Okay. Just,
I can smell the freedom from here.
Okay. I can't get off the couch.
Oh, God. Okay. All right. Let me get back. All right.
I can't get off the couch.
Look, if we don't get out of here soon, the cops are going to be here and we're going back to prison.
I don't think I want freedom. I think I want to go back.
Okay. Okay. I mean, if we go back, then, I mean, they will cook our meals for us and they'll tell us where to be. We don't have to make any choices.
I called the cops on us. They're going to be here.
You know, we've tried freedom for so long and we just keep screwing it up. Maybe this is what we need. We just need to be behind bars.
Yeah. I don't know how to take care of myself.
I'm going
to
seal up the escape hatch. We don't need it. Come and get us.
We're guilty. Take us back, please. I want to work in the library again.
It was such a good job.
Yeah. People paid attention to us. We were somebody.
We were somebody. Oh, God. Same. Nice.
Okay.
That's great.
Okay. So there was a lot of twists and turns there.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought we were in prison at first, you know, but we kept it so vague. That's what I love about Vague to Clear is that, like, it still leaves so many possibilities open. And then when you finally pay them off, it feels so much more satisfying. Like if we had just started out with like, yep, we're going to go to jail if we don't get out of this living room soon and find our brother, that feels so heavy handed and like, okay, I guess I'm interested. But when you start out with, I can't go back to jail like that. I mean, I'm like, I don't know who you are, but I'm in.
Well, and I think too, like I was working off, we're on Zoom just so people know if they're listening, but I was working, you set such a strong emotion from that. And I'm like, okay, we did something, we fucked up, we'll find it together. And that's the fun part of the scene, you know? And then, you know, you're a master at agreeing and just taking all those things that I threw at you and agreeing to them.
And vice versa. Yeah. And I know I've always, you know, I never took your class, but I had a lot of friends that took your class and I've always loved your philosophy of slow comedy. It's like, just slow it down. Like, cause when you go fast, you miss a lot of the little nuances. Right. And I love going fast. I love playing short form and different things like that. But when you're playing a slow, grounded, patient scene, you can find those little twists and turns because of the subtle little things that you say or don't say or whatever.
So, and that was a blast to play with you because we've never played together.
Yeah, we've never played together.
What do you tell a student? And I think you talked about this in your book about an exercise is different. What you do in class is different than what you do on the stage.
Absolutely.
What do you tell, like somebody goes, well, you know, that wouldn't work on stage or that's too long for us to get to the scene work.
I mean, it would depend on the scene, but like that scene we just did, I think would totally work on stage. But I mean, I get that a lot. People will be like, I came here to you know, get laughs and be funny and we're not being funny. And so, you know, it's a cliche, but I use it because it works. In The Karate Kid, Mr. Miyagi made Daniel-san do a whole lot of things before he did karate. And Daniel-san hated painting the fence and waxing the floors and doing all those things. He hated it. But what he didn't realize was that he was learning karate moves while he was doing it. So that way, when he was like, all right, show me paint the fence. And he was like, oh, this is actually block, right? Or this is strike or whatever. And the difference between me and Mr. Miyagi is I just tell my students ahead of time, like, we're going to do this. You're going to develop this skill. It's not necessarily going to be, it might be funny, but it's not, we're not going for fun. It's not funny in a vacuum, but we're working on this skill. And then it will add on to all these other skills later. And then when you put them all together, that's when you hit a stage and you try and, you know, bring the comedy. But like as a basketball player, you don't just hand someone a basketball and go scrimmage. You know, you go, let's work on dribbling with the right hand. Now let's work on dribbling with the left hand. Now let's go over the bat. Now let's do all these little fundamentals and piece them together bit by bit until you've got an arsenal of weapons and skills at your disposal.
Well, and I think you do it so beautifully in the book. It's like one lesson at a time. You know, it's blocking and tackling. Let's learn this one lesson. Let's master that. You'll never master it, but let's get good at it and
then get
move on to the next.
Absolutely. Because that's the only way I've ever learned how to do anything is layers, you know, one layer at a time. Anytime I try and like learn three things at once, it's too much for me. I don't know if I'm not smart enough or what, but I just can't do it. So I teach the way that I learn.
One more thing from your book, and it's something that, you know, I've been teaching a while, and I see constantly, and it doesn't matter who I work with, if it's people from, you know, overseas or people from different cities, this whole idea of one line at a time.
Yes.
And people feel like they have to monologue, you know, information and stuff like that. Tell me a little about, you know, your feeling or your philosophy on getting people to do one line at a time.
My favorite exercise, and I don't think I invented this, but I honestly don't remember who did. So credit to whichever improv teacher I learned this from. But I have them do a scene where I say, okay, the first line's going to come out. You know, I'm giving a suggestion. First line's going to come out like normal. But then I'm going to be silently counting to five over here. And when I'm done counting to five, I'm going to say, you may speak. If you are not the one who just got the first line, if you're the second person, that's when you may speak. But you don't have to speak. You may speak. You may take another 5, 10, 15 seconds of silence, and that's fine. And here's the trick. While you're in that silence, you're going to be very tempted to think of your next line, of formulate what you're going to say. I strongly urge you not to do that. Instead, what I want you to do is I want you to take stock of everything that's happened up until this point. Even if it's just one line, what was said? What am I getting off my partner's face? What am I getting off how far apart distantly we are? What object work's going on? What was the suggestion? Just analyzing what's happened before. And then when you're ready to speak, if you've been concentrated on everything that's happened in the scene before, then what I have found that what you say will be so much more of a response to what's happening as opposed to what you were thinking about. Right. And then if they say more than one line, I literally, nope, you got your one line, full stop.
So let's just take let's just do that really quickly. Sure. I'll give you a line.
Okay.
And then it's, you have 5 seconds and then it comes back to me. Is that right?
Yeah. Then I'll come up with a line. I'll digest it for 5 seconds or more. And then I'll say a line and then we'll just do a scene back and forth.
Okay. Great. I got the tickets for the concert tonight.
And I got the beer.
I got some cigarettes.
Susie and Dottie are going to be so impressed with us.
I got some condoms too.
Dale, tonight could be the night.
Breathing heavily.
I am also a little nervous.
I'm sweating.
Yeah. We should be drinking these beers now.
Okay, cool. That's better. Oh, man.
Okay, I feel a little more calm.
I do too. And scene.
Thanks.
Okay, great. That was very interesting for me.
Oh, please tell me.
Because waiting that 5 seconds kind of erased anything. And then the line that I was saying, it was coming off what you were saying, but it wasn't like like sometimes when someone says the first line, you're like, oh, I got to force it. I got to immediately respond to this and just connect the dots. And there it was more, it was almost, for me, it felt almost stream of consciousness, but I was still responding to what you said emotionally and also verbally.
Absolutely, right? And you know, and for guys like us who've been doing this so long, our brains are pretty much trained to react instantly. And we're probably going to say something pretty good because we've been doing it so long. But especially for people who've been doing this 5 years or less, particularly if it's just like a year or two, like their brains aren't there yet. So like you need to take the time. What I like to say is, you know, the first time you got on a bike, you didn't start at the top of a big hill and go down by yourself, you know, at 80 miles an hour. That'd be insane, right? You start on flat ground, you had someone right next to you, you know, double check and everything. So it's like when you're learning improv, start slow, start slow, start. You don't learn anything by starting fast. There's no one that goes, oh, you've never picked up a bow and arrow before? Well, give me three shots. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, it's like you take your time and you figure out how does this feel? And improv is the same way. It's you don't have a thing, but it's the speed is the same thing.
And the thing that I found is if you slow it down, like you're great at starting with a very subtle, but you know, I could pick it up on Zoom emotion, and by slowing it down, you then bring the emotional part of the game that sometimes when you're starting out and you're just, you know, it's a clever wordplay, you're going to drive over that. You're going to pass that. And that to me is where the scene is.
Absolutely. The scene is in those little nuance parts, right? It's just like anything else, right? If we try and rush to get to the end, we miss stuff. And the only time I don't think you should ever feel rushed, ever, no matter how much experience you have. But some of us are going to go through that faster just because we've done it longer. But if you're not there, if you're like, I've been doing improv a year, slow it down. Slow it down. Find those moments. You know, and I would say even if you're doing improv 10 years, you probably could benefit from slowing it down.
Well, we've got to slow down ourselves, and we've got to end this podcast. We've got this podcast. We don't adjust anything. It's fine. We always end the podcast with the same question. What piece of advice would you give an improviser starting out today?
I would say... I'd want to give him a million pieces of advice, but the thing I would say is listening is the most important fundamental skill, not only in improv, but in your approach to learning improv. So if you can master listening, if you can work on your listening, you're going to be ahead of so many people, even people who have more experience than you. Listen, listen. And by listen, I don't just mean ears. I mean any kind of observation, intake of information. Slow it down. What's happening? Listen.
And I see copies of your book back there. Mm-hmm. Improv Made Easier. How can we get there? It is again. If you're listening to the podcast, Rich is holding his book up again.
Up. Yeah.
And how can we get a copy of that book?
Best way right now is just because we're in a COVID world, just order it off Amazon. There's a Kindle and a paperback version. One thing I'm going to be working on over the next few weeks is trying to get the audio version happening. So in case people like audiobooks versus regular paper books. But yeah, I was selling them at my in-person workshops, which there aren't any anymore for who knows how long, which is why I have a zillion of them. I had three in-person workshops lined up and I was like, I'm buying a bunch of copies of my book. And here they are. But yeah, I'd say Amazon, just Improv Made Easier. There's no other book by that title, Rich Baker. I don't think there's any other authors by that. So Improv Made Easier, Rich Baker. Or you can follow me at Rich Baker Coaching on Facebook. That's where I put a lot of my stuff, my episode, you know, like free content and different things like that. And I'm always hawking the book.
You know, we didn't talk about this at all, but everybody has moved, not everybody, but a lot of people, including myself, we've moved to teaching online. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that, any piece of advice you'd give people, you know, like myself or anyone out there that are teaching online that you found?
I'd say the energy that you bring into your in-person class, you need to double it and temper it. So I can't be, hey, welcome to my class, but I have to have that same energy of like, hey, everyone, we're going to do some scenes, you know, and it's just, I do a lot more bits In these online classes to keep people laughing so the energy is up. Because most of us are sitting, most of us have been on at least two or three Zoom calls that day. And I just read an article today about how Zoom calls are kind of draining in many ways, you know, because you're paying attention, you're feeling like you're always being watched, that kind of thing. So as a teacher, I'd say just call it the elephant in the room. Hey, this is different. It's okay. We can still learn. And you know, it's, and if anything comes up just like it would in a class, let me know. Hey, I'm feeling uncomfortable. I'm doing this, you know, whatever. But as the teacher, we have to really provide the energy in this two-dimensional flat world.
I'm glad you say that, because my experience was I was doing bits too. And I'm like, that's not usually how I do in the classroom, but
you need
I'm
to keep them laughing.
Classroom. I have
you
to
need
adjust.
To keep them laughing. You need to keep
the
them
other
laughing.
Thing. I'd be curious too, is what number of people have you found that works the best on doing Zoom? And
yeah,
let's take that question first, and then I'll give you a follow-up.
10. I'd say max it at 10. You know, a lot of improv classes max it at 16, at least in my experience. And I've certainly taught 16 in a room. It's a little difficult, but I've done it. When I teach more than 10 on Zoom, it's a disaster. Literally, I think 10 is the absolute max, because you want to see everyone. You want to have, you know, if I'm doing 10 people in two-person scenes, then everyone's going to get in at least a scene for every 45 minutes. And that's a good ratio.
And what's a good time frame? Because like you said, people are on Zoom and they've been, you know, they're burnt out sometimes by the time they get to class.
So the Second City classes are still rocking at 3.5 hours here in Hollywood.
3.5 hours?
Yeah. So we do a lab. I didn't know about this either when I first moved to LA. So in classes in Chicago are, you know, 3 hours, and that's that. In LA, they're 3 hours, and then the last 30 minutes you do a lab, which is where your class goes into another class, or they come into yours and you perform for them, like a little mini performance kind of thing.
That sounds kind of cool.
At first I was like, what's this? But then I was like, oh, I really like this. Mm-hmm.
What do you like about that?
Because it gets people up on their feet when someone's watching who they're not intimately comfortable with. Like, you can get a classroom of strangers to get really comfortable performing for each other, because, you know, they're in this together all 7-8 weeks, whatever it is, you know, you're a unit. But the minute you bring in another class to watch, you've brought a different element. And so now you're showing them, hey, you're failing. Or you're succeeding, probably failing, and it's totally okay. It's 100%. And then you watch the other class who might be ahead of you or behind you, and they're failing too. Maybe get a little, you know, you're laughing together at the successes, you're laughing together at the failures. It's just bringing a unity. You know, one of the reasons why you take a Second City class versus some independent coach's class is because you want to connect with other people who are at Second City or IO or wherever. And so I really like that about the lab part when we're in person. What I found online is that after about 2 hours, you're pretty much done. Most people's attention span stops. So what we've been doing to modify that for Second City is we've been doing two breaks instead of one. So usually do like one break in the middle. And we'll do like a break in an hour and a half, and then another hour and a half, we'll do a second break just to get people some variety. But when I'm in charge of the class and how long it is, 2 hours.
Rich Baker, thank you so much for being our guest on Improv Nerd. This was so much fun, not only to get to interview you and read your book, but also get to improvise with you.
I'm honored. And I just want to say again, I've been a fan of yours for quite some time. You know, I've seen you perform a bunch. You're the kind of teacher that, you know, I'm trying to be, just, you know, just being around helping people with the best of intentions. And I'm just honored to be on Improv Nerd.
Well, thank you so much. Take care. And there you have it. Another great episode of Improv Nerd is in the can. I want to thank the author of Improv Made Easier, Rich Baker. And for more information about Rich Baker's coaching, go to facebook.com/richbakercoaching. Check him out on YouTube, which is youtube.com/richbaker, and pick up his book, Improv Made Easier, available on Amazon. I also want to thank my producer, Dan Schiffmacher. He's the one who makes me sound so slick and so professional. If it wasn't for Dan, you wouldn't be hearing my voice right now. If you want more information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning improv classes that are now online in workshops, go to my website, jimmycorain.com. And don't forget to like the Improv Nerd Facebook page, because it really helps with my low self-esteem. Follow us on Twitter at improv_nerd. And thank you for listening. And remember, as always, walk, don't run. He's a nerd.